From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. One of the promises of the Republican Revolution was to clean up business as usual in Washington. The party rose to power in 1994, in part by claiming the moral and ethical high ground. Last week's Senate hearings on the activities of lobbyist Jack Abramoff revealed that his shadowy money trail led right to some of the party's most powerful players. Now Republicans face a crucial credibility test. Will they tolerate corruption in their midst? Tonight on Point, the Beltway Bandits ride again. But first, we begin tonight with the latest twist in the investigation of how a CIA officer's name became public. Time magazine said today that it will comply with a court order to hand over the notes from a story Matt Cooper wrote about CIA officer Valerie Plame. The New York Times, whose reporter Judith Miller also faces possible jail time, said it was deeply disappointed by Time's decision. The Supreme Court on Monday refused to hear the reporter's appeal. James T. Mador has been covering the story for Newsday and joins me now. James, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Well, certainly not a happy day for journalists. What caused Time, Inc. to cave on this one?
Well, it's been an interesting day for journalism because many of the people that I've spoken with about this case over the last 8 months did not expect to see the two journalism organizations part ways. You have the New York Times taking one approach. You have Time magazine taking a different approach. And Norm Perlstein, who is the editor-in-chief of Time, Inc., the parent company of Time magazine, and a very respected journalist himself, he spent years at the Wall Street Journal before coming to Time, he said that a journalistic organization cannot be above the law, and because the Supreme Court decided not to intervene in this case and to allow lower court rulings to stand, Time had no choice but to turn over the reporter notebooks, the email, all of the work of its White House correspondent Matthew Cooper, who is one of two people at the center of this case. As you know, Matt Cooper earlier this week said that he hoped Time would not turn over his work product. But they decided to do so, as Norm Perlstein said, because Time is not above the law.
Well, isn't the New York Times facing the same pressures that Time, Inc. is facing?
They are facing the same pressures, and they've decided to take a different approach. In fact, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher of the New York Times and the chairman of the New York Times Company, was adamant today, saying that New York Times reporters had gone to jail in the past, and if they have to go to jail in the future, they will, to defend what the Times believes is journalists' work protected by the First Amendment. The problem here is that it is a very gray area. We have no Supreme Court ruling that clearly states that confidential sources and a reporter's work with those confidential sources is privileged under the First Amendment. And the hope was that this case would be heard by the Supreme Court and there would be some clarity. Unfortunately, that did not happen. And as it stands now, the New York Times is taking one position, which is that Judith Miller will go to jail rather than unveil her anonymous source. Time magazine saying the opposite. Time magazine saying, we're not above the law. The law says that Matthew Cooper's work is not protected, so we have to turn it over.
Well, presumably this would mean no jail time for Matt Cooper, but do we know that for sure? And do we know for sure that Judith Miller would have to go to jail?
That is very unclear. It is, in fact, many experts are divided on this. There's going to be yet another hearing in U.S. District Court in Washington on Wednesday. At the very least, some experts are saying Matthew Cooper would have to testify because he would have to verify and vouch for the material that his employer is going to hand over to federal authorities. Some have speculated that Judy Miller will not have to testify and will not have to go to jail because presumably Matthew Cooper's notes would be sufficient. But we don't know that for sure, and we do not know if the source that spoke to Judy Miller is the same source that spoke to Matthew Cooper and is the same source that spoke to Robert Novak, the Chicago Sun-Times columnist, who originally outed CIA agent Valerie Flame, who, of course, is at the center of all of this. And this investigation originally began because Ms. Flame's identity as a CIA agent was divulged by Robert Novak, who spoke with a member of the Bush administration who identified Ms. Flame after her husband had been critical of President Bush's evidence concerning weapons of mass destruction and the reasons for war against Iraq.
All right. Well, James, thank you. We'll be watching it as you will.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
James T. Madour is media reporter for Newsday. He spoke with me from New York. In Washington, money is power, and lobbyist Jack Abramoff brought bags of it. He hit the jackpot, peddling influence to Indian tribes and spread the spoils to Republican power brokers like Ralph Reed, former head of the Christian Coalition, Grover Norquist, architect of the K Street Project, and House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. For a Republican Party that promised a different and cleaner kind of government, the damaging details of soliciting megabucks from Indian tribes, then laundering the money, is more than an embarrassment. Some of the party's heaviest hitters could go down, and they may not go quietly. With congressional elections looming next year, the Republican Party has to decide how far it will go to clean house, whose heads should roll, and who will do the chopping. Are you following the Jack Abramoff scandal? Does it sound like Beltway business as usual, or is this something worse? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in just a few moments, we're going to be hearing from Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. Joining me right now from the Capitol is Massimo Calabresi, who is Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Massimo, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, this is such a big story. There are many complications. We'll do our best to make it clear, if not completely simple. So for the benefit of anyone who hasn't been following it closely, maybe let's start with the cast of characters. Who is Abramoff?
Jack Abramoff is a very interesting character. He came up early on in the Republican movement as a leader of the College Republicans back in the early 80s, right after Reagan's first inauguration. And he came up right at the same time in the College Republicans as Ralph Reed, the future Christian Coalition leader, and Grover Norquist, now head of Americans for Tax Reform, and sort of the guru of anti-tax conservatives in Washington. He after a solid rise in the Republican ranks in the early 80s, he left, went to Hollywood, became a B-movie producer, produced a couple of sort of vaguely anti-communist movies. Red Scorpion, I think, was one, and then came back to Washington as a lobbyist and arrived just in time to represent the newly rich Indian tribes, Native American tribes from around the country, who were suddenly awash in cash from casinos, and also had a number of political issues that needed tending by a lobbyist as a result of those gambling interests.
So, in essence, Abramoff, Reed, and Norquist, all big players in the GOP firmament now, but essentially got to know each other, became buddies when they were in their 20s.
That's right. It was sort of, you know, that first, in the conservative movement at the time, there was a, sort of a real euphoria after the 60s and 70s dominated by liberals. Here was a moment when Reagan and conservatism seemed to be changing the country, and they were all together sort of at that heady time. You know, various things they did together included organizing rallies, burning the Soviet flag outside the Polish embassy to protest martial law, and so on. It was they were very much brothers in arms early in the conservative rise in America.
And so now, what exactly is Abramoff accused of doing?
Well, the most serious charges he faces so far have come from senators who are looking into how he handled his Indian clients. Senators Dorgan and McCain, the Democrat and Republican in charge of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, have both accused him of fraudulently taking money from his Indian clients without their knowledge. There is also an investigation underway at the Senate Finance Committee, in this case led by Charles Grassley of Iowa, looking into whether he used tax-exempt organizations, charities, as a way of hiding some of the money that he took from these tribes and then used for his own purposes. For example, he funneled a lot of money to a private Orthodox school that he set up for his children. He had a relatively, high living lifestyle, bought, fancy BMWs and things like that, played a lot of gambling, golf, and so on. More importantly, as far as the business of Washington is concerned, he's accused of funneling money in ways that are either illegal or violate the ethical rules of the House of Representatives and the Senate to various senators and representatives, taking them on trips, taking them to spas, things like that.
All right. We're going to be getting into some more of those details in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about Republican super lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his trail of gigantic lobbying fees, how far it goes and where it leads. Have you been following the story? Does it sound like business as usual or something worse? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide, and by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions, thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy, cmndesign.com.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Republican super lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his money trail, how far it goes and where it leads. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think the GOP should do about its beltway bandits? And how should the Democrats respond? I've been speaking with Massimo Calabresi, Washington correspondent for Time magazine. And also joining me now from Washington is Matthew Continetti, staff writer for The Weekly Standard. Matt, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
So what do you make of this? What's been the reaction to this story within Republican circles?
Well, there have been two reactions. I guess the first is kind of a blissful ignorance on the part of many movement conservatives. They don't want to be troubled by the details of this pretty outrageous scandal. They also don't want to face the political consequences that might result from the fallout, in particular with Tom DeLay, the majority leader in the House, and more broadly speaking, the Republican majority in Congress. In next year's midterm elections. The second reaction has been kind of one of righteous indignation. That's on the part of Senator John McCain, who, of course, is a Republican and who is chairing the lead Senate investigation into Abramoff. People like David Keene, the head of the American Conservative Union, in Time magazine this week coming out against not only Abramoff and what he did, but also people like Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed for kind of colluding with Abramoff to use this money taken from the paid willingly, of course, from the Indian gaming tribes. Then there's also someone like Georgia State Senator Casey Cagle, who's actually challenging Reed in the Georgia primary for lieutenant governor, another race that's going to take place next year, and is an interesting one to watch to see just how the breakdown between kind of a movement conservative like Reed, who's associated with this scandal, is now being pursued by a more insurgent-type Republican like Cagle, who is making these gambling fees a major issue in the campaign.
Well, where do you see this on the continuum of, shall we say, questionable behavior? Is this illegal, what he's been doing? Is it unethical, or is it simply not the sort of thing that you want to have come out about you?
Well, sure. I mean, it's unseemly, and this is the key factor here. We're not sure about the illegality of what exactly happened. When you talk to lobbyists and you say, you know, look at what Abramoff did, I said, well, the fact is what makes Abramoff different from most of what goes on in Washington every day is simply the amounts and also kind of the boldness with which Abramoff kind of set about bilking the Indian tribes of tens of millions of dollars. We're talking upwards of $40 million, maybe as high as $80 million that he and Scanlon took from the tribes. And we're not
over
actually sure.
Over a period of 3 years. I mean,
over
that's,
a period of three
that's
years.
A lot
yeah.
of money over 3 years, $80 million.
It's a huge amount. And it's funny, one of the payments, I think from the Choctaw Indians, went to Scanlon and Abramoff for about $7 million. And the Indian Affairs Committee found kind of the breakdown of how that money was used. In fact, of that $7 million, Abramoff and Scanlon only used $1 million to actually conduct their lobbying. They took the rest and split it 50-50 in their program, which they called Gimme Five. So they were doing not much for a whole lot of money. So the unseemliness counts. And why is it unseemly? Well, it's unseemly for exactly the sort of reasons that you were saying at the beginning of the program. Republicans came to power 10 years ago promising to drain the swamp of corruption. You know, one of the Democrats who fell on election night 1994 was Dan Rostenkowski, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, who was under indictment, 12-count indictment, at the time of the election, and then lost his seat because Republicans were promising to change the way Washington worked. One Republican called for a new order. And as we see 10 years later, in fact, only the names changed in the parties.
Massimo Calabresi, you have been covering this story for quite some time now. How did it first come to light? And give us a little bit of the flavor of it, of some of Abramoff's own words, which have emerged through these emails that have now been made public.
Sure. The emails are what really have made the story catch fire in Washington, but it did start in sort of an interesting way. A small-town reporter down in Georgia who covered the local tribes found that they'd been spending just inordinate amounts of money on lobbying and sort of pulled on that string a little bit and found that this money had been going to Abramoff, found that he was, well-connected. Around that point, people up in Washington started to take notice. But when the emails did come out, someone managed to get their hands on a simply enormous stash of his emails from when he was at a variety of different lobbying firms around town. They showed, pretty brazen greed on his part. He called his Indian clients morons and monkeys and talked about he and his partner Scanlon talked about taking all their money and the focus of the emails really was largely on it always returns to whether or not they're getting paid, how much they're getting paid, when they're getting paid, who they're going to cut off so they can make more money. It's pretty unswimming. This guy, you get the image that comes to mind is tipping over a rock and suddenly seeing all the bugs that were, squirming around underneath.
I want to bring into the conversation now Carlos Heza, who is Lieutenant Governor of the Tigua Indian Tribe. Hello, Carlos, and welcome to you.
Hello, Gail. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Tell us what your experience was.
Well, my experience with Jack Abramoff, the tribe's experience as a whole. Back in February of 2002, our casino was closed down. Mr. Abramoff approached the tribe. He was referred by an attorney out of Santa Fe, New Mexico, with the solution on how to reopen our doors in our casino. Again, the solution was trying to insert some language in the bill that was gaining momentum in Washington. And by inserting this language, we would be able to open our doors. He charged us $4.2 million to try to open our doors. This money was supposed to be paid out to Mr. Mike Scanlon. The efforts it failed. The bill did pass, but our language wasn't inserted on there.
And then later you found out that, in fact, he had helped Ralph Reed try to close your casino in the first place?
Yes, that's the insult. We never knew that Mr. Abramoff was working behind the scenes to close down our casino in the beginning. He came down and offered to reopen, not telling us that he had work behind the scenes to close us down, along with Ralph Reed.
Now, along the way, it certainly appeared to you as if this was on the up and up, right? I mean, there was a meeting on Capitol Hill, and you were assured that things looked good, right?
Yeah, we had several meetings with Jack Abramoff down in Capitol Hill. We did get to meet influential individuals in Washington that assured us that everything was on track.
And then what?
And, it failed. Our efforts failed. But now the evidence that has been gathered by the Washington people only shows that it was all a big lie. He was working to close us down, and he came and presented us with a plan that was never really created to succeed.
Is the casino open now?
No, it's not. We have an entertainment center where we provide the community here with concerts and a nightclub.
And so how do you feel about all of this?
I'm devastated. I personally took a lot of fault. I was blaming myself because this was sort of a responsibility given to me by the tribal council. But how could I have known that all this was working behind the scenes? I mean, we did do a background on Mr. Jack Abramoff. He did work for one of the top law firms in the nation, so we had nothing to lose. I mean, everything that we checked on him really came back as this is a man that could open our doors once again. So I was devastated, but again, it was a con, and they covered their footsteps.
Well, Carlos Heza, thanks very much for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure.
Appreciate you joining us. Matt Continetti, you know, no matter who you are, this kind of thing just has to make you squirm, doesn't it?
It makes you squirm. It sometimes makes me chuckle. I mean, and I don't mean to sound insensitive, but the whole thing kind of has a comic opera sensibility. I mean, the kind of the gall involved to have Jack Abramoff close down the Tiguas Casino and then within about 6 months come back to them and ask them to pay him over $4 million to reopen it is really quite stunning. And I mean, you kind of you end up laughing in disbelief. And I think voters may have the same reaction in 2006. There's every indication, I think, that the Democrats are probably going to run a national anti-corruption campaign against the Republican majorities in the House and Senate next year. And they're going to be pointing to the Abramoff case, I believe. Just today, I think I received half a dozen, and that's exaggerating, probably two emails from the Democratic National Committee demanding that President Bush return the over $400,000, I think, that Abramoff has raised for him in the past election cycle. Abramoff, Ralph Reed, another of those $400,000 donors or fundraisers, very important elements in kind of the Republican machine that now governs Washington.
Massimo Calabrese, I want to go back to you to point out that, you know, Republicans do now control the House and the Senate and the White House, and the number of registered lobbyists has more than doubled in the past 5 years. Many of them make about $200,000 to $300,000 a year. But is this any different from how lobbying has traditionally been conducted in Washington, including under the Democrats?
Well, the first way it's different is the way Mr. Continetti pointed out, simply the amounts involved. And that really is, as he said, the thing that everybody stops on. That $60 to $80 million figure is breathtaking, even by Washington terms. It also is a source of concern. You know, when there's that much money, it has to have gone somewhere, and it wasn't just his kid's school. So reporters around town are kind of, you know, digging on that, and politicians are kind of worried about where it went. But I think the thing that gives it greater importance here is something that Mr. Continetti was getting at, the way the political fallout. It's not just the Democratic Party's desire to use this for the midterm election, which they clearly are going to try and do, and there's an irony there given that they were in 94 the party that had succumbed to you know, the corrupting influences of money and power. This money did make its way into a lot of pockets around town, not just you know, fundraisers for Bush at a distance, but even meetings that Grover Norquist arranged for the for anti-tax activists from around the country with President Bush, More so on Capitol Hill, it's even more blatant. Abramoff was paying for golfing trips for Tom DeLay with Indian money in ways that are against House rules. He was loaning out his skybox for fundraisers for a number of Republican congresspeople around the country. So they would wine and dine their, potential donors at Abramov's expense, again, in ways that appear to have violated ethics rules. So I think, as far as Washington and political power is concerned, there may be a bit of traction for candidates, either from the Democratic Party or in, say, Republican primaries, as is the case against Reid, that they can make something of this politically.
I want to go to our phone lines now. From Cary, North Carolina, we have Don on the line. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Very interesting topic. I believe that there has been no change with this so-called shift to the right. The nation is deeply divided, very dissatisfied with both the right and the left. As we in America muse about the corruption in the recent Philippine discovery about their election, the Russian corruption, I feel that lobbying is a form of legalized corruption. And I believe the greatest proof of that is that there is no lobbyist for the poor. There is no lobbyist for reparations. There's no lobbyist for people just to do the right thing. So those are my thoughts.
Well, Don, thanks very much for joining us. Matt, I want to go back to you and ask you about Democratic interest groups. Are Republican interest groups any different from Democratic ones? In your view?
I don't believe so. I'm not sure any kind of political scientist type or student of American government would say that they are. I mean, one of the beauties of our system is that various people can pursue their own special interest. And as the founders kind of put it in the Federalist paper, the hopes is that the interests will cancel each other out. And like the caller suggested, he said there wasn't a lobbyist for the reparations. When I heard that said, I immediately thought Randall Robinson, very famous author and professor, who has made reparations a huge issue. Well, not a huge issue so much, but an issue. I mean, the reason we're discussing it is that there are lobbyists for that. I think what makes Abramoff different is two things. Again, just the scale of kind of the corruption, one could say. And the second thing is that there's been a, and I think, as you pointed out, Gil, in the past 5 years, the number of registered lobbyists in Washington has doubled. And so it's already been on an upward track since the 1970s, and coincident with the rise of the Republican Party in the country. But to have it double in the past 5 years is pretty staggering. I think the danger here is that the Republican Party, which has helped a lot in kind of this explosion, is basically ceding great amounts of political power. Any notion of the public interest, they're ceding that to these business interests, basically, and may come to haunt them in the end.
Well, I want to ask you also about the K Street Project. That, of course, sure. is the GOP effort to get lobbying companies to donate to and preferably hire Republicans exclusively. Is that, good job if you can get it done, or is there something insidious about that?
Well, there certainly is to the Democratic lobbyists who are losing their jobs because of it. But I think if you talk to Republicans, they think that this is just the way that a governing majority is working. Now, there has some.
Also, if I could jump in, just to point out that the reason there's a lot of catching up for the Republicans to do is because the Democrats dominated for so long. The number of Democratic lobbyists in Washington was far, far higher than the number of Republican lobbyists.
Okay. Thanks for that point, Massimo. So you're not exactly drawing back in horror at this idea?
Well, no. I mean, the reason why I think any reasonable conservative should kind of be concerned about things like the K Street Project is exactly that. Is why did Republicans come to power? Well, they came mainly to shrink the government, or at least that's what I remember signing on for. And that's not the case. What happens is that the government keeps expanding, and the number of interests trying to get a piece of the pie is expanding with it. For Republicans or conservatives to facilitate in this, I don't think makes them worthy of the name.
it's an interesting dynamic at the moment in the Republican Party, as Matthew pointed out right at the beginning, that there are two points of view on this. Up on the Hill at the moment, for example, there's a small group of young freshman Republicans who are very much in the kind of horrified and indignant camp, who are talking about instituting much stricter rules for the acceptance of private money for trips for Congress people. So there is at least some indication, not just on the Democratic side for political purposes, but also on the Republican side for ethical purposes, that there's the start of some backlash that could actually lead to more substantive change, I think.
More to be said here. We're going to continue our discussion after we take a break. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the money trail of Jack Abramoff, how far it goes, where it leads, and what the Republicans should do about it. Some say the GOP should clean up its own mess, and fast. Do you agree, or are you looking to the midterm elections for a course correction? Does the scandal make you more or less committed to voting in 2006? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm speaking this hour with Massimo Calabresi, Washington correspondent for Time magazine, and Matthew Continetti, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. And Matthew, to you, do you think that if there is a move to send Abramoff, Scanlon, and Reid somewhere into the hinterlands, that they are likely to go quietly?
Oh, not at all. And Reid, in particular, I spent a little time with him a few weeks ago, and he's very as forthright as he can be, I think, or as forthright as his lawyers let him be in tackling the gambling issue. He understands that it's going to be a big concern in the primary race, and then if he manages to win the primary, which I'm not sure is even a likelihood at this point, he would still have to face his Democratic opponent bringing up these sorts of issues. Definitely not going to go quietly into the night. Nor is Grover Norquist, the anti-tax activist who's a longtime friend of Reid and Abramoff. And Norquist is very influential in Republican circles, a very powerful lobbyist, and he's going to exert his influence. Nor, for that matter, is Tom DeLay. And you saw an interesting dynamic in the spring when there was a huge attack on DeLay from certain good government groups tying him to the Abramoff scandal. You really did see the right rally around him. And so it's going to be a very fine line that the Republicans and the conservatives will have to walk between supporting their leader, a very successful leader like Tom DeLay in conservatives' eyes, and yet kind of diminishing the negative influences on their movement and in the Republican Party that were represented by people like Reid. The best thing about someone like Reid is there's some emails uncovered by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee that have Abramoff telling his business partner, Mike Scanlon, that Ralph Reid is too greedy for them. I saw that. I was floored by it. I mean, how could you be too greedy for Jack Abramoff?
Massimo Calabresi, I want to come back to you and ask about how vulnerable you see Tom DeLay at this point. You know, I'm thinking back to Trent Lott and various other people over the years. It's as if things grow and grow and grow and grow and grow, and somebody can seem completely safe, and then suddenly, boom, it's over.
Yeah, in March, there was, you know, a real chorus around town of people who were convinced that DeLay was on his last legs and it was only a matter of time. And these weren't necessarily partisan types or newcomers to Washington. They were old hand political watchers, reporters, and so on. And it was remarkable to see the wagons circling up on Capitol Hill. And there's a couple of reasons for that. DeLay has been a phenomenal fundraiser for a lot of members. He's gotten them a ton of money, helped them win their elections, and they're loyal to him for that. There is a degree of fear. People who've crossed him have not fared particularly well in the past. The other thing that's working for him is that a lot of people took money from Abramoff, and a lot of people made the same sort of oversights, decisions, mistakes with regard to how they funded their travel. So on the travel scandals alone, the conventional wisdom in Washington seems to be that is not enough to bring him down. If there's something that really leaps out, that people in individual members' districts start to complain about, that is when people say he's through.
What was that great quote, Massimo? It may have actually been in one of the pieces you wrote about, if money were purple, there would be a lot of purple pockets in Washington.
Yeah, that that was at the most recent Senate Indian Affairs hearing. There's just that's the thing that's going to keep this story going, frankly, is just there's a ton of money that Abramoff touched, and it's just sluicing around town, and we're all looking for it.
I want to go to Boston now. Jay is on the line. Hello, Jay.
Yes, hello. Very interesting topic, and I appreciate you covering it. My comment is the following. I think that the Abramoff situation gives us a very interesting window into a modus operandi for the conservative movement. I could label it Republican or call it right-wing, where the MO is to create an artificial crisis and then come up with the quote-unquote solution, which is either personally self-enriching or for the group, or is beneficial to the pursuit of other political objectives. I think one could argue very viably that Jack Abramoff is cut from the same cultural cloth and even joined at the hip with Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, Tom DeLay. It's a very tight-knit group, and obviously there's no moral compunction about shutting down someone's casino and then extorting them to reopen it. I could extend this further. My own personal view is a lot of the military adventurism, the out-of-control Pentagon spending, even the so-called war on terror, one could argue falls under the aegis of this same concept. And I'd be very interested in your guests' comments or any other callers.
Thanks for the call, Jay. Let's put that one to Matt Continetti first.
Well, I think it's an interesting analogy. It may be stretching the taffy a little bit too thin in some places, but I think the concern the caller raises, which is an important one, is, I mean, looking out, we have 14 months to go until a midterm election, so anything can happen. But the dynamics in place, what you have is basically you have about a year for the Republicans to kind of clean up their act, not only domestically with the kind of the Abramoff mess and the charges of the corruption, but also, I think, as the caller points out, internationally speaking. You know, the president has about a year to make sure that the war in Iraq is viewed as a success, or at least a series of successes leading to an eventual drawdown of American forces there. And if in a year, in the summer of 06, we're sitting here saying that, those things haven't been accomplished both domestically and internationally, I think the Republican Congress is in big trouble.
Well, and also, what happens now to Ralph Reed's campaign for Lieutenant Governor of Georgia? I mean, how upset is the Christian Coalition with him being involved in privately taking gambling money while speaking against gambling in public?
Right. Well, the Christian Coalition in Alabama, where Reed had closed down some video gaming, video game poker machines a few years back, is pretty incensed. There's a Democrat Alabama state legislator who has called for the Alabama Attorney General to open an investigation to Reed. Now, Reed is running for Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, and there the party is split between people who are supporting the state senator, Casey Cagle, and then kind of the more establishmentarian, I guess you could say, Republicans in Georgia who are supporting Reed. It's interesting, a few weeks ago, a prominent yet longtime opponent of Reed's, a prominent Republican, the former leader of the Georgia House, came out in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution against Reed's candidacy. But then, of course, the same day that that happened, or a few days later, rather, Reed had welcomed Senator Zell Miller, the quote-unquote Democrat from Georgia, and Sean Hannity, the television personality, the very popular conservative television personality. He welcomed them to the state where they full-throatedly endorsed him. So there are battle lines that are being drawn, I think.
To Manchester, New Hampshire now. I want to hear from Jan. Hello, Jan.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to, if you'll pardon another analogy, the drug trade in America would not exist if there wasn't a demand for it. And likewise, in Washington, where so much attention focuses on the lobbyists themselves as being the corruptors, too often I think the congressmen themselves seem to wiggle out of accountability. Because while the money may not dry up, a congressman each election time could make a public pledge to basically immune themselves from lobbying as much as possible. Maybe they should start disclosing as part of their re-election campaigns how often they meet with lobbyists. And that may be a matter of public record now, but it's not very visible.
Jan, an interesting point. Thanks for the call. Massimo Calabresi, you know, it is interesting, isn't it, as you watch these things over the years. I mean, congressmen will say, listen, and women, the second we get into office, we have to start raising money for our next campaign. Is that really what the issue is here, or is it more insidious than that?
All but the very richest senators and representatives up on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, for that matter, have one eye always on their campaign money and where it's going to come from. The last time all of these issues really came up was in the 90s with the campaign finance scandals. And it is interesting. There's a reason it keeps coming up, and that's because what is legal in Washington is, by and large, for much of the country, really not acceptable. Lobbyists not only, you know, come into people's offices, you know, frequently, often push the interests of the people who are paying them money that may diverge directly with the majority of the constituents of the elected representative, but in many cases lobbyists actually, and it's shocking to say it, but it's widely true, write the actual language that gets into bills, and a representative will happily trot that out onto the floor and introduce it either as an amendment or as part of a bill, and it becomes law. So lobbyists and Congress people are working very, very closely. There is no shortage of people who would like to see the system changed, but of course that's a very complicated thing. There are First Amendment issues, and these have been tried in the courts. And then even when you get different types of reform, they don't always necessarily accomplish the job. When there's a lot of money and a lot of lawyers involved, it's usually possible to find a way around people's attempts to limit this sort of thing, as evidenced by McCain-Feingold Act that was passed with the intention of controlling some campaign finance funding, and automatically new ways sprung up to get the same job done.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank
you. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Massimo Calabresi, Washington correspondent for Time magazine, and Matthew Continetti, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an American correspondent in Baghdad remembers a fallen Iraqi colleague. This is On Point. Yasser Salehi, an Iraqi correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers in Baghdad, was killed last Friday, reportedly by U.S. forces. Salehi was driving alone when he approached a roadblock in western Baghdad. He was shot amidst the confusion there. Salehi's death demonstrates the dangers that continue to plague journalists and all Iraqis in all areas of the country where violence persists. Salehi was a medical doctor who became a journalist in 2004 because of the low salaries paid by the Iraqi government. Knight Ridder reporter Tom Lasseter worked closely with Yasser Salehi. In this radio diary, he remembers his colleague and explains what happened last Friday night.
Yasser was on his day off last Friday. He was going to get some gas for his car. He was taking his daughter to the pool, and he was in Amaria, a neighborhood in western Baghdad. Before he had gotten to the scene, there was a joint U.S.-Iraqi patrol passing through the neighborhood. It's a neighborhood in which the patrols had received a decent amount of sniper fire in the past. So they're going down the road, and they see someone on a building, and so they quickly turn around and block off the intersection with a Humvee and three of the roads leading to this intersection. And then on the fourth road leading into the intersection, they post Iraqi soldiers on one side and American soldiers on the other. And so Yasser comes driving into this intersection, and he's on the road that is not blocked by Humvee, but a road in which, again, Iraqi troops are on one side and U.S. troops on the other. So there's some conflicting account here of how many warning shots were shot, but there was certainly one which hit the front right tire of Yasser's car, and then there was a second shot that went through the windshield, hit him in the forehead, and killed him. It seems fairly certain that the shot that killed him was from a U.S. sniper. It's not uncommon, I suppose, to hear of Iraqis being shot at a roadblock. It's a very complicated, very diffuse environment. We constantly have to worry when we're out on the roads, you know, whether this person in the road wants you to come forward to show you your ID or whether they want you to stop and not come forward. You know, if they want to see your ID and you stop down the road, they think you're suspicious and might, you know, potentially take a more aggressive posture toward you. It's really difficult sometimes to determine exactly what's going on, you know, especially when you just sort of come upon the scene, and especially if there's gunfire. U.S. and Iraqi troops in Baghdad face a very real threat of car bombs and suicide car bombers. And their profile for that is, you know, single male in a car approaching them. The people on the other side of that roadblock, the U.S. and Iraqi troops, often have to make, you know, very, very quick decisions about what to do about this oncoming vehicle. And, you know, those decisions carry an awful lot of weight, both for the people in the vehicle and for themselves. Yasser came to us early last year. He was a medical doctor, a surgeon at Baghdad's Yarmouk Hospital. Yasser had worked with some media companies in the past doing some translation, but was looking to be hired full-time because it offered a substantial raise over what he was making at Yarmouk. I mean, he covered or helped cover just, you know, about every major event during the past year to have happened in Iraq. He really took to the work, and I think that he felt that he had lost something in a way from leaving the medical profession, something that he loved and had a lot of pride in. I think that the success that he found in journalism helped balance that, and Yasser certainly held his own.
Tom Lasseter is Baghdad correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Yasser Salehi was killed last Friday. He was 30 years old. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.